Okay, so the first part is non-credit entitlement. So we start with unentitled methods, and when I say a method basis is LOCC, like local, it means it can be implemented using just local operations, quantum operations, and classical communication between labs. So if it's a big two qubit basis, I'm imagining like two labs, right? Like each lab is only a qubit. And so this is a direct product, so it's just like the first qubit, the first lab is measuring in the z basis, so you have half of 0 or 1. And the second lab is measuring in the x basis, so you have a plus or minus. So the basic structures are fixed, and this is a two qubit measurement, right? But there's another way you can do a two qubit measurement, which is you can do it adaptively, right? Like where the labs can talk to each other, so there's some classical communication. So where the first lab tries to measure in the z basis, so there's an outcome 0 and an outcome 1. But depending on the outcome, the first person sends it to the second person's lab. And if the outcome is 0, then the second person measures in the z basis, so observes outcome 0 or 1. If the outcome is 1, then the second person decides to measure it in the x basis, so plus or minus. So there's an adaptivity of measurement choice on the part of the second person, right? So we're using the classical communication in the second one. In the first one, there was no classical communication, right? They have fixed choices. Here's an example of something that's non-adaptive. So it cannot be done using local operations and classical communication, but it's still a product basis. So it's not something that requires entitlement. There's no entitlement factors here. And the way to see that it's non-adaptive is maybe just this, that if you look at this three-qubit basis, none of the parties has a fixed choice of measurement basis, right? Like because for each lab, the basis seems to switch, like, you know, sometimes the z basis, sometimes it's the x basis, and so on, right? And there's some complicated correlations between them. So in order for this to have an LCC protocol, you need a starting party, you need someone to do a first measurement, right? Like someone to be in the global cost of all the third name parties. So this person does the first measurement, observes the outcome, sends it to the other two, and like, you know, there's some complicated ordering with the other two. This is how you would imagine. But that story doesn't work here. So this is just to give you an intuition that you cannot implement it, using classical communication. Okay. So So this is an example of an unentangled measurement that you cannot do with LOCC, right? So if you contrast that with your understanding of states and entanglement, like usually we call entangled things that you know you cannot prepare in LOCC. So this has to do with basically it's an example of what's usually called a separable but not LOCC kind of operation, right? So it doesn't require entanglement. Okay, so the example I just showed you is known as the shift basis in the literature. We look at this particular example in this talk. So the first statement is that it's impossible to perfectly discriminate these states, which are all locally preferable. So you can prepare them locally. Each person just has to prepare a qubit in a fixed state, either 0 or a plus or 1 or minus, right? Like, so you can prepare them locally, but you cannot discriminate them via LOCC perfectly. So if I tell you that the ensemble of states is this, it's one of these 8 states. And if I ask you to tell me which of these 8 states you received, the 3 parties, no. And if they're only allowed to do local measurements and allowed to talk to each other, they cannot tell me with probability 1 which of the states they were given, right? That's the sense in which this is quote unquote non-local. Okay, however, this assumes a causal classical communication between the labs, right? Like the intuition I was trying to give you that there has to be a starting party for the protocol, right? And under that assumption, you cannot do this. You cannot discriminate these states. Which implies that at least one of the parties has to start the thing, so it has to be the global cost of the other two. And I only gave you this intuition that, you know, that would be the starting party. There's no starting party for this basis. So then the natural question that arises is what about classical communication that pays to respect power law, right? So you want to relax something in LOCC. You want to retain local operations, but we want to change classical communication to allow for communication that may not be possible, okay? But still classical. So we're still sending bits around, but it may not respect a causal order. Okay. Is that okay? Because this is just the first half. Okay. So if you now have intuition for what the phenomenon is, then we can move on to the second part.
No, just checking, right? If we had, let's say, a first party that was doing a thing, but then the nature of the adaptive measurement would be different. So like
then
what? So you gave an example of an adaptive measurement versus Alice measured first, and depending on Alice's outcome, the basis for Bob would be different.
Yes.
So could we just now have the Charlie measures first?
Mm-hmm.
And if Charlie measures zero, then we run the adaptive measurement that you described in the Allison model where Alice mm-hmm. measures first.
Yeah.
If Charlie measures one, mm-hmm. now Bob measures first, and then Alice would do her measurement based on Bob's outcome as the measurement. So here you still have like there is one party who definitely goes first,
mm-hmm.
but the order of the other two parties
is
not fixed on that. Can you come up with sort of like a beyond LSEC there?
You cannot do it with that kind of protocol. Yeah. Because even that protocol assumes that there's something, someone that starts the protocol, right? Like A can decide the order of B and C, but like at least there has to be someone who has to start the protocol. Either it's A, B, or C. Right? And that's part in the global past.
Even though there's no definite causal order, you're saying, because I would have thought that LSEC.
This is under definite, so this is dynamical causal order,
yes.
But in the sense in which I mean indefinite, I mean it means beyond even dynamical order. Like you cannot explain it even with a dynamical kind of causal order.
Okay, so
there's a stronger notion. So when people talk about causal inequality violations with classical processes, for those who know what those things are, they basically mean that you cannot reproduce these violations even with a dynamical kind of causal order. But
so
relying on that to claim that you cannot do it.
Can you mix like dynamic and stochastic? So you can say that Alice does a measurement, so she gets the zero outcome. And then there's some sort of additional hidden aspect. And so with 75% probability, Alice will go for Bob in this case for Charlie. But for the same case, she's still Charlie getting outcome zero, there's a 25% chance of Bob going for Alice. And that those probabilities are reversed if Charlie gets the different outcome. So here it's dynamic, but dynamic and stochastic. So it's
yeah.
like, if you allow for this, where there's still sort of like things which can depend on external randomness and not the results of previous parties, then what's the difference between having like which party measures first is determined by a coin flip? Right? Like, so
I don't think that's
actually
involved, but I don't know how that would be right
now. My recollection of the paper is that they give a very, very careful proof that it's not, I mean, you give a sort of proof by spec.
Yeah, I kind of give an intuitive argument.
Yeah,
it wasn't
a very rigorous proof that under lock protocols you can't distinguish this. You can imagine, for example, bringing an ancillary and entangling it, performing some really tunnel measurements. I mean, all those lock protocols aren't capable of distinguishing those states. It's the proof itself is not straightforward.
It's a bit they compute basically the fidelity with which you can do it, right? Like the best you can do kind of the prayer for balance.
Just on the same point, hey, a long time ago I read this, but my impression was that what they were aiming to prove in the paper was that you can't even get an epsilon of measuring this thing by LSC. So the protocol that they were imagining is suppose that Alice starts first, but she does an extremely weak measurement, which is almost just identity, just a tiny little bit of information out, very little disturbance. And she uses that tiny bit of information to tell Bob what very weak measurement Bob should do. It's sort of like every step of the way, they're only changing things a little bit, and then maybe it all converges to this basis. So the tricky part of the proof was showing that that's not possible. Anyway, that was my recollection.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, I never actually worked out the proof myself. I just took it on faith and it works. But the intuition I'm trying to give you, kind of the reason I'm trying to give you that intuition that no parties in the global past is because that's going to be relevant when I'm going to talk about the role of this classical process in discriminating the thing. It'll become clear. Like there was a reason why I was trying to motivate it like that.
One final question on this. Is it true that if I wasn't worried about epsilons and all I cared about was proving that this cannot be measured exactly, then I probably wouldn't need the big guns of their proof, and it would be enough to just say, look, somebody would have to start by doing a strong measurement and nobody can, and that's
the kind of thing I'm trying to say, like, because you want to do perfect discrimination, right?
Yeah.
And you want to, so I'm imagining like any probabilistic thing will sort of like maybe get close, but not going to be perfect discrimination,
right?
So, and there's no global pass, like the combined perfect discrimination plus no global pass is kind of, that's the intuition. I mean, I haven't written down like
It might be more than an intuition. It might be that if you don't care about, if epsilon has to be zero, then the proof could
be. Yeah, I think it should be more than an intuition. I just haven't written it down. So
okay.
That's why I'm not sort of saying it more strongly.
But then also, I mean, we wouldn't have to consider these sort of stochastic protocols. It would be like dynamic deterministic causal orders. And if there's no dynamic deterministic causal order, then we can't get this sharp measurement.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That is true. Yeah, I mean, that's just based on my intuition from actually the connection that I will show. Okay, so what do we mean when we talk about classical communication without causal order? So for this, I'm going to introduce something called a process function. So you may have heard of people working on indefinite causal order. They talk about process matrices. And one way to think about process functions is as like some sort of classical limit, classical deterministic limit of process matrices. But that's not how I'm going to motivate it. You can think of them on their own independently without worrying about the process matrix framework. So what is a process function? A process function is, first the setup. So when I talk about a process function, I'm imagining that there are like n distinct local labs, okay? And each lab has exactly one input port and one output port. So it receives a classical input and it sends out a classical output. That's all it can exchange with what's around it. Okay, so that's a restriction. Free local intervention that can map inputs to outputs. So the labs can be quantum, they can be doing quantum stuff inside. That doesn't matter, but because the input is classical and the output is classical, it can always be thought of as some stochastic map in the output, right? So they could be doing quantum things inside the lab, but eventually they have to map a classical bit to a classical bit, right? So I just wanted to say that because that's exactly what we want to see in the discrimination protocol. And within each lab, there's an assumption of causality that the input precedes the output. Okay, so there's locally it's definite causal order. There's a total order over the input and the output. Right? So the input happens first and then the output. Okay, so we're assuming that. So this is the basic setup. This is just what I'm imagining. Right? So each lab, they can do stuff inside, which effectively I can just think of as a function from the input to the output, so mu A. Same thing for B and same thing for C. Okay. So the throughout like the process I'll be talking about will be just a binary one. So there'll be a one bit input and a one bit output. Okay. So these functions can just be take four possible things. They can be identity, flip, a constant function which maps whatever it receives to either 0 or 1. Right. So there's four possibilities for these functions. Okay, in the simplest scenario. Okay. The second assumption of the framework is that the labs are embedded in some environment. We don't know the nature of this environment. We don't know what set of this environment and that they can't really control or intervene upon the space in which they're embedded, okay? where the labs are situated. So this environment is the thing that dictates the causal order between the labs. Okay, so we're assuming a definite causal order inside a lab, so from the past to the future. But between the labs, we're not imposing an a priori assumption that they are partially ordered with respect to each other. We're not trying to embed them into a Minkowski spacetime, for example, okay, at the moment. So the causal order would be definite in the sense that there's a partial order over events of the different labs. And or it could be indefinite, which is that there's a failure of partial order. You cannot imagine a partial order. Okay? The correlations are such that you cannot explain them under a partial order. Okay? That's what I mean by indefinite. And the resulting correlations between the labs, right? So the causal order will dictate the kinds of correlations you can establish between the labs.
Dynamic, you're putting as definite or indefinite?
Definite. Yeah. Okay. So this is the picture. So they're embedded in this weird cloud. We don't know like what laws of physics generated this cloud, but it has some behavior that we're not going to talk about. So that behavior is this, right? The environment will define some sort of a classical channel from the outputs of the labs to their inputs, okay? So what the environment is receiving from the labs are these things, X, Y, and Z, right? And it's going to provide to the labs A, B, and C, okay? So you can effectively think of it as a channel from X, Y, Z to A, B, C, okay? Yeah, and we'll look at the deterministic case that I was trying to explain. So we will look at just So it's a function basically, right, from 3 bits to 3 bits. Okay. So yeah, so this is, I'm writing it like a conditional distribution ABC given XYZ, but this is just deterministic when I'm thinking of a buffer channel, right? It's just a function from XYZ to ABC. Okay. Okay, and there's a further constraint on this classical channel, namely that this deterministic classical channel should satisfy what's called logical consistency. Okay. So intuitively, the idea of logical consistency is that this channel should be such that regardless of whatever maps, local maps, the parties implement, whatever interventions, local interventions they do on their bits, it should never lead to a grandfather type paradox. Okay? It should never lead to a situation where you can go back in time and destroy the bit you receive, stuff like that. Okay, your grandfather. Right? Yeah. Okay, so technically what that means is that for any set of local interventions, so for any given choice of interventions that the parties could make, remember, each party has 4 possible interventions they could make, right? So in the binary case, there are 64 possible interventions. Right? So each party can independently choose their interventions. For any set of local interventions, so any of these 64, there exists a unique set of inputs, which we call a fixed point. So inputs, by inputs, I mean the ABC that the parties receive, right? So there exists exactly one set of inputs to the parties that is returned back by the classical channel. So basically, the classical channel returns the parties the same input. Okay, so it's a fixed point. If you compose the classical channel with the local interventions, and the input to the local interventions is returned by this composition of these two maps, right? So it's a fixed point of that the composition. Okay, so that's a constraint on the classical channel. It's not arbitrary classical channels. It's ones that satisfy this constraint. Okay, and this constraint is meant to avoid grandfather type paradoxes. And I know Rob is probably thinking how to make one up right now. So this is what it is: deterministic classical channel plus logical consistency that defines a process function. Okay. And if you want to read more about in more detail about how these things were right, that this original paper by Baumler and Wolf. And I forgot to say this is joint work with Eamon Baumler at ECOPT Vienna. And this more recent work that I guess, well, Eleftherios didn't talk about this, but this has a nice discussion of process functions, this paper. Okay. So I would recommend these two papers if you're interested in the classical processes and understanding them independent of the process matrix framework, even if you didn't believe in the process matrix framework. I think it's an important thing to think about. Even classically. Okay, so that's it. The cloud is the classical channel which satisfies logical consistency. Okay, now I will say a few things which are meant to be sort of intuitions for how these process functions behave. These are not kind of, I'll qualify all my statements. So here I'm going to say a process function is causal if and only if the associated classical channel. So this follows from the sort of considerations of causal inequalities. But in this talk, I'm not going to talk about violations of causal inequalities. We're going to look at a different application of these processes. Okay? But this comes from there. That's the sort of thing. So if it's causal, if and only if the associated classical channel is either a constant function, which means that the labs are not talking to each other, they just choose their own functions, right? That you're not coordinating the inputs between the labs, right? Like based on the outputs. You're just giving a constant input to each lab, right? Or if it's causal signaling, right? Like the fact that, you know, A can signal to B, and like output of A can determine the input of B and stuff like that, right? But causal way, not the case where like from both of them did that at the same time. That would be non-causal.
I think this is the convex hull of all deterministic dynamic.
Yes. The causal stuff will be like that. But here we just talk about deterministic things, so. We don't even need to talk about convex hulls right now. Okay. So it's all deterministic. Yeah, I'm resisting introducing probabilities because I know Rob will tell you that probabilities are epistemic and I shouldn't be. So that's why I want to keep everything deterministic.
So the switch that like I showed you talked about, like A points to B, B, and there's the log. This would be causal under this. Deficient because they
it will not violate causal inequalities. because depending on the switch variable, you will go either one direction or the other. Right?
Yeah,
you will never go both in the same time. Okay, so when I say causal signaling, it basically translates at least one part, it implies that at least one party is on the go pass, right? That's a necessary, not a sufficient condition.
Yeah, I think that was a very good question. But like that parenthetical comment, it doesn't really capture what everything you're assuming.
Yeah, well, not everything.
The second pair of parties are also ordered.
I'm insisting on, I'm just keep mentioning this again and again because when I talk about this AFBW process, you will see that there is no global pass, and it's kind of interesting too. So that already tells you it's kind of not possible, right? Because that this necessity condition will not be satisfied. So that's why I'm kind of repeating this kind of thing again and again. And otherwise, we call it non-causal, which means that it will violate what people call causal inequalities, which I'm not going to talk about in this talk, because I'm going to show you a different application of these processes. Okay, so now the important thing is that the one party and the two party process functions are necessarily causal once you impose that logical consistency constraint, okay, of a unique fixed point for any choice of dimensions. So in the one party case, it's just a constant function where you just receive an input. There's no signaling from your future to your past. Okay, so it's a constant function. And in the two party case, it's either a constant function or one way signaling from Alice to Bob or Bob to Alice, but not both. Okay, so this definition excludes loops for one and two parties. There's no self loops and there's no loops between two parties like that. Okay? So everything is causal in the one party and two parties. And so the surprising thing about this AFBW process is that if you think about three party process functions, if you go beyond two parties, then they need not be actually causal. Okay? So process functions can be constant, just like here, or causal, like they can kind of signal in a causal way, or they could be signaling in a very non causal way. So that's going to be the process that I'm going to talk about. So this possibility only exists in the three-party case. And in the process, for those who know the process matrix framework, in the original paper, they also showed like in the bipartite case, you can have a violation of a causal inequality if you define an appropriate process matrix. But classical processes don't violate those things, right? And that has to do basically with this kind of thing, because they will define valid process functions and those cannot violate the thing. So the classical and the causal things kind of coincide up to two parties. But the third, when you go to the three-party case, you can come up with a process function completely classical, which violates a causal inequality. So it's no longer the case that you necessarily need to have some weird quantum stuff going on to violate a causal inequality. That's the lesson of the fact that you can do it with three parties. Okay, that's important to note. Okay, and three and more, actually, four or five could have affected. So there's a discrete jump from two bipartite to multipartite situations. So what is the AFBW process? It's a tripartite process function that wires the outputs of the three labs to their inputs in a sort of a manifestly non-causal way. Okay, so this was the setup. This is the environment. And that's the kind of wiring that the process imagines. So it imagines that for each party, the input that the party receives is a function of the outputs of the other two parties, right, in this way. So it's basically, A equals 1 whenever Y and Z are 0, 1. Right? So it's conditioned on Y being 0 and Z being 1. You get A equals 1, right? Otherwise, you get 0. And the same thing is true of B. B depends on Z and X. So when Z is 0 and X is 1, then B is 1. Otherwise, it's 0. And similarly, C depends on X and Y in the same functional way. So when X is 0 and Y is 1, you have C equals 1. Okay. So this kind of, if you read this process carefully, like, you know, all these functional relations have to hold at the same time. Okay. So that means that each party, the input that the party receives is dictated by the outputs of the other two parties. So in that sense, each party looks like it's in the causal future of the other two. If you just look at the functional dependence. So that's the sense in which there is no global path, because each party looks like it's in the future of the other. Okay, so as I said earlier, quantum stuff can happen inside the lab. They could be doing quantum measurements here, so quantum stuff, okay? But it's important that the output of the lab cannot signal back to its input. That's what the logical consistency thing was ensuring. Okay, so that's kind of excluded in the framework. So if you just look at the input output table of this process, so the process itself, it receives, so this is, these are the outputs of the labs, right? And they serve as inputs to the process. Outputs of the lab are inputs of the process. And the inputs of the lab are the outputs of the process, because that's what the process feeds to the labs, right? And so if you look at the functional form, this is what it looks like, right? So for the for these inputs, the possible outputs are these two, right? Now the for under these functional dependencies. Okay, this is a simple way to kind of write down what the table is. Okay, so you just shift this input bit string left for the first column of entries, and you shift right and flip for the second column of entries. So for example, for 001, if you shift left, it's 010, and if you shift right, it's 100. But then you bitwise flip everything, so that's 011. Okay, that's just a code shorthand for remembering what these things are. Okay. And so that those are the function dependencies. Okay. Is that okay? Like everything okay for now? Okay. Okay, so now that I have defined the two concepts, two things that I need, I can try to illustrate how they're related.
Probably.
Yeah.
In case for the other bit strings of ABC, there's just no consistent assignment.
Yeah, exactly. So the way this process is effectively ensuring logical consistency. So basically, the parties are not going to receive arbitrary inputs, right? They're going to receive inputs given by the process, and the process dictates that they only receive either 000, 001, 0101. That's just the space they're living in. Like, you know, it's God given in some sense. That's how you're imagining this. But the process itself could receive any of these 8 possible inputs, right? That's, it's a function from the outputs of the parties to the inputs. So it's many to one from the outputs of the parties.
Yeah. Did you not imagine that those outputs are also not arbitrary, like X, or is it important that X finds it really be arbitrary? Yeah.
Because they can generate whatever, right? Because the pre interventions, they can generate whatever bits fix they want. Because the region that the parties have is inside the lab, it's the maps they implemented. The labs, and those can generate whatever they want. Like that's what you're saying.
Yeah. They can control their output, they can't control their input.
Yeah. I mean, they control their input via the process, so that they don't have complete free, they don't know what input they're going to get. It's the process that dictates that. Right. Okay, so in terms of results, the first result is that remember how the shift basis, you cannot implement it with local operations and classical communication. If you had access to this process, namely the three labs holding a qubit each, were living in an environment where they could communicate in this very non-causal way, then they can actually do the perfect discrimination task using just local quantum operations. Okay, that's the first result. That is, they can use this process to implement a local protocol for that discrimination task. They don't need to bring systems together and measure them, because in a definite sort of causal order, they need to bring systems together to measure them. Okay, so that's the statement. Three parties communicating through the AFBW process can measure quantum systems in the shift basis using local operations. Okay, and that's the circuit. So, what do we imagine here? So, imagine that the parties get one of these. So, this is actually just the implementation of the shift measurement itself. It's not just like a discrimination task, but just implementing the full basis measurement and using local sort of operations. Okay. So this side could be arbitrary, but for the discrimination task, given, you know, this file will come from that ensemble of 8 states. Okay. So for now, just think of it as some 3 qubit state that the parties receive. So each party receives a qubit. And furthermore, each party, so the star here is basically the input port, you know, the stuff they get from the environment. And this star here is the output port, the stuff they send to the environment. Okay. So these are classical variables. And depending on what they receive from the environment, whether it's 0 or 1, if it's 0, they're not going to do anything here. This is just going to be identity. So that's this. If it's 1, they'll do a harder mode on the qubit. Okay? So they will change basis basically. The x basis will change to z and the other way. Yeah. Okay. And then they do a computational basis measurement. They do a z basis measurement. and they report the outcome of that Z basis measurement, whether it's 0 or 1, to the environment. So that's the output that the party sends out to the classical, the response to whatever processing. You know, this is the classical outcome, right? Label for what they saw. And then they basically reverse this sort of evolution. They kind of apply the stage again, and then they can actually hold a qubit in this case. Okay, so that's each party does that. That's the thing. And what this diagram is essentially representing is this, right? So given psi, you measure, well, of course you evolve it according to H A B C, depending on what ABC the party receives, right? And then you measure the computational basis. So X, Y, Z can be anything from 0, 0, 0 to 1, 1, 1 in the computational basis. And this is the probability of seeing a certain X, Y, Z. And then the state that they're holding, the state that they quote unquote collapse to in each lab is, and then you apply the same algorithm on that state. And so the final state looks like this, right? After the protocol is done. Okay. Now, how does this implement the perfect discrimination protocol? The way this implements the protocol, I mean, I already described it, is the bits ABC received from the process, they specify basically the basis in which they're going to do the measurement, right? So if it's zero, then you're measuring in the Z basis, you're not doing anything here, right? But if it's one, then you're measuring the X basis. Basically, you can think of it as just changing the basis, right? Like in which you're measuring the edge here, right? So they're measuring the Z basis or the X basis depending on which bit they receive. And this corresponds to the ABC, the inputs they get. And then once they do this measurement, whether it's Z or X, they obtain an outcome which will sort of specify the local basis state. So zero, like if this is the basis choice, you know, if the outcome, if the measurement was in the Z basis, they see either 0 or 1. If they see 0, they basically the thing they output is 0. But or if they see 1, sorry, if they see 0 or plus for respectively Z or X measurement, they output 0. If they see 1 or minus for Z or X measurement, then they output 1. Okay? They send it to the lab. And so basically, what happens is if you do this, you are the correlations here basically allow you to implement this measurement. And the way to see it is that, as I said, ABC are the local basis choices, right? So if it's 0, 0, 0, that means Z basis, Z, 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 right? And these are the basis states in that basis. So 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1. That's these two basis states, right? Just I'm encoding the basis choice in ABC, choice of ABC. So 0, 0, 0 is Z, Z, Z. And these are the basis states in that basis choice. So these are the two basis states from the Schiff ensemble. And then when it's 0, 0, 1, then the basis choices are Z, Z, X, right? Because 1 corresponds to measuring the X basis. And the corresponding basis states are 0, 1, 0. So that corresponds to 0, 1 plus. Because remember, the basis is X here, because the third bit is 1 here, right? And 1 corresponds to the basis minus, the basis state minus, right? Okay, in the X basis. The same thing is true here. When you go to the basis choices are Z, X, Z, you are basically, and then you prepare basically 1 plus 0 and 1 minus, right? These are the basis states for that. Okay. And the same thing here. 1, 0, 0 is X, Z, Z, and these are the basis states according to the table. Right? So the intuitive reason why this protocol works is because the table actually contains exactly the correlations you need to be able to discriminate these basis states. Okay? And you can do locally because all interventions are local in this framework. Right? Okay, and obviously this also goes in the other direction. That is, if you give me the shift measurement device, so you know parties receive some bits. So now they're trying to simulate the channel that corresponds to the AFPW process. Okay, so there's nothing exotic going on here. They're just trying to simulate the correlations of AFPW. So the channel, not the process, because the process has causal connotations. So to implement, so they can turn the shift measurement device into the channel corresponding to the AFPW process. So here, each party will locally prepare a qubit in the Z basis, depending on which they receive. Okay, so X, Y, Z can be arbitrary, it can be 0, 0, 0 to 1, 1, 1. Depending on what they receive, they have prepared qubits in those states, so 0 or 1. And then they do a shift measurement. So you can measure on the shift basis. Okay, yeah. They don't need to know the inputs of the other part inside. Like they just do a shift measurement, and that will be enough to generate the correlations they need. Okay. So they apply shift measurement with these local outcomes. So if they do a shift basis measurement, then locally they either see 0, 1, plus or minus, right? Like one of these things. So they do that here. So LA, LB, LC can take these values. And then they just do a classical post-processing. They relabel the outcomes to 0 or 1, depending on the basis. So if it's the Z basis, they relabel the outcome to 0. So if LA is 0 or 1, you relabel, this function relabels it to just 0. If it's plus or minus, it relabels it to 1. Okay, so we're basically trying to backtrack. We're trying to kind of do the reverse of what I was talking about earlier, right? And so if you do this mapping, you will see that the ABC you get satisfies the functional relationship required by the AFPW process. Okay. So that's the statement. But basically, if you're doing the shift measurement, and if you think of these ABC as, sorry, these X, Y, Z and ABC as like sort of encoded in the way that I talked about, then you're basically simulating this channel. Okay. That's what we're saying here.
Question.
Yeah.
I think I've misunderstood because that phase is measured on computational basis product state.
Yeah.
It doesn't give a deterministic outcome.
Yeah.
So how can the overall input output functionality be deterministic?
So how can the overall input output function? Yeah, because we're doing this relabeling here, right? So whether you get 0 or 1, you just map it to 0. You're doing that basis measurement.
You're doing this. This coarse grains away all the indeterminates.
Exactly. Yeah. So this function here,
yeah,
sort of restores the deterministic channel problem, right?
Okay, that's what I missed. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So that was the mapping. So I showed you something that you cannot do with just local operations in a definite kind of causal order, like so if you're in your regular space time. You can do it with just like local operations if you have access to this kind of weird process. And secondly, that when you do a shift measurement, it contains exactly the correlations. The mathematical fact underlying it is just the fact that under an appropriate encoding and decoding, like you know, it's exactly the same correlations. Okay, that's the simple fact.
Doesn't give you some dependence, like if you change the sort of if you look at the last on the table of the eight. Sure. Okay. So here, if you look at the last case, let's say you got the X, Y, Z are 0, 0, 1 and 1, 0, 1.
Mm-hmm.
Right. When Alice learns that for her now A is 1,
mm-hmm.
Essentially it does matter. Like she does get information about the others. She knows
yeah.
that
Y and Z has to have choice.
Y and Z are different.
Yeah.
So
not just different, they're 0, 1.
Yeah. Oh, they're 0, 1. That's right. So why would you say that like nobody learns about somebody's outcome depends on the other?
I know that was just to kind of emphasize that these correlations are just coming from the shift basis and not because I could forget about all this and just write down a classical channel, right? It's just a classical channel. It's not a this statement is just to say that I just need to prepare my qubit and send it to the shift device. If I had access to what Y and Z are, then I just kind of so here I'm not actually assuming process access to the AFPW process. I think like the thing you said is like if you know what the AFPW. Here we kind of simulated starting from the shift measurement. Right. So there's not much to simulate in some sense because it's like it's not an exotic situation, it's just like a regular situation. You're just given the thing in the lab and you want to do it, but you didn't have to do this to generate a channel. It's just a classical channel. You can generate it without any form of stuff, right? if you knew what Y and Z were. Here's the, so that statement is just to emphasize that the correlations are coming from the shift measurement and not just classically knowing the inputs of the other partners. Okay, so I showed you this connection in the three-qubit and the three-party case, right? For the three-qubit measurement unentangled, you can implement it locally using a three-party process, a binary process. You can generalize this observation from three qubits to n qubits. Okay, so it's true for a multi-party situation, it's not just a three-party situation. So that's the general theorem of which what I showed you is an instance, which is that if you're given an n-party Boolean classical process, so the same situation, parties receive bits and send out bits, but now you have n parties, more than three in general. If it maximally violates causal order, then you can kind of write down a set of basis states which exhibit quantum non-locality of time. Okay, so you just use the correlations in the process to generate the basis.
Can n equal 2 in that case?
It doesn't work for n equals 2, because then it'll be I should probably say that in the statement of the theorem, the point. It was implicit. But, because if it's a classical process, it cannot violate causal order, right? In the two-party case. So I don't really need to say it. Yeah, because it's included in the definition of classical process, so it cannot be two-party. And we say maximum violation, it just literally means that each party can receive a bit from at least one other party, right? Like, so it's in the future of at least one other party. Maybe not all of them in party, but at least one. Okay. So which means there's no global cost. That's what one is trying to say. And then using, so this kind of shows you that this thing that we're doing has some teeth in the sense that you can take results from generalizations of this ASBW process, people looking at more generalized process functions. And you can turn them into new examples of quantum non-locality without time. So even if you didn't care about this classical process, like whatever indefinite causal order, there's a pragmatic reason to maybe think about them because it lets you sort of construct these kinds of ensembles, if you care about these ensembles. If you don't care about them, or not, I should say. But if you care about these, then this also tells you that actually encoded in them is somehow the structure of these classical process functions which are non-causal. Like, at least in this multi-qubit case. So that's the takeaway that, you know, we showed this kind of equivalence between the shift basis measurement and this classical process. This thing generalizes to a family of multi-qubit sort of bases through the theorem that I talked about by actually using generalizations of this process. So in some sense, if I was to give an intuitive account of what's going on, we're kind of trading causal order for locality of operations. In doing this, like we're kind of relaxing the causality assumption in the classical communication and restoring like the fact that you can do it with local operations. Okay, so we're kind of like trading one thing for the other in some sense. Thank you. And you can find more details in this paper. Thank you.
Thanks. I think that was interesting. We have more questions.
That's interesting. Did you think at all what are called locally unextendable product or unextendable
product bases?
Like instead of having your eight state, go back to the eight state.
If you throw some of them out and do some things.
Yeah, so like if you look at the ones that are have a pattern like plus one and zero.
Let me go back to the same thing maybe. Yeah.
Yeah, so there's three of them that have a plus, a one, and a zero. Mm-hmm. So you get your numbers 2, 3, and 4. So if you take those three and then you add minus, 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 you get 4.
These three?
Yeah, those three.
Yeah.
And then you take the product state minus, minus, minus. Mm-hmm. Then you get 4 product states that are orthogonal. And if you look in the four-dimensional subspace, the complement of those guys, you will find not a single product state.
Yes.
Everything complement is entangled.
Yes.
And if you take the mixture of those guys, you get bound entangled state.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's kind of interesting. If there was something about these things are also locally immeasurable, like there's no LSTC protocol that can change them. So if you can make a connection between that and indefinite complement, then you know, you would also have a connection with bound entanglement. And the stuff that Katja Reed and I did on bound entanglement was also kind of about causality, like whether it's common cause or cause effect. So it's not totally implausible that there would be a connection between bound entanglement and causal structure.
Yeah, and I'm guessing the kind of thing you want to do, I'm not sure we'll be able to do it with entirely classical processes, because the classicality of the process was related to the fact that it's, I think it's an unentangled kind of basis. I can think of each body doing its own thing, right? Like if I have entangled vectors, then it's harder to, I think, reproduce things through local operations, and like just using classical processes. But maybe it's the case that if you look at quantum processes and the process matrix framework, which cannot be interpreted as process functions, then maybe there is some kind of nice connection to be drawn there. Like, I don't see an obvious way to do it with just classical processes because there's entangled vectors. And actually, like, let me make a comment here, because I did think about these, but not in this context. I thought about them in the context of contextuality. So the connection was that this kind of so in trying to prove a result, which was about okay, this talk was not supposed to be about contextuality, but I'm going to mention a result anyway. So the result was about how, even though these bases are kind of, so in some sense, this is an example of a basis that you cannot do in a Bell measurement, right? Sorry, not a Bell measurement, a Bell scenario. Because in a Bell scenario, all measurement choices are local. So you only do product kind of measurements. You don't do like even adaptive or non-elastic. You don't do those kinds of measurement bases. So if you think of a Bell scenario as kind of like this hypergraph picture, like where the vertices are the outcomes, and like when you draw these edges, which are the non-signaling and the normalization edges and stuff, there are some extra edges that come from these kinds of things. And I guess these are like the virtual edges, I'm not sure. But these basically don't add any constraints to the set of probabilistic models. And so this statement, the thing that I just said, is relevant for proving that if you want to have quotient Specker sets, like unquantable sets with multi-qubit states, then you need entangled vectors. And that is kind of related, I think, in some sense. Maybe we even show that you can't do it with UPVs, like, you know, when you complete UPVs with, actually, I don't know if we managed to show that, if you need full entanglement. No, I don't think you need full entanglement. You can kind of do it. Sorry, this is like completely unrelated to what you were saying.
Well, we should talk later, because Youngchun Liang and I, years ago, right after we put out that paper about the Specker stuff, mm-hmm. also had kind of proofs of contextuality that were based on these non-locality without entanglement constructions.
Okay.
We haven't published that, no. I can't remember the details, but probably related to it.
Okay, I would like to see what kinds of proofs you can construct. You can't construct the logical kind of proofs. But maybe it's statistical proofs, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, but you can't come up with like the logical contradictions that quotient Specker relies on, basically, without entanglement.
Yeah, these are proofs of generalized contextuality.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I mean, so that's another direction to kind of think about, like in some sense, because since these processes, these classical processes are kind of connected to these kinds of bases, which never give you quotient Specker contradictions. Like, a natural thing to maybe ask is, like, you know, how does the result about the fact that you need entanglement in your vectors to have a quotient Specker contradiction translates to this kind of picture, right? These are kind of the boring measurements from a quotient Specker sense. The interesting measurements are with entangled vectors. What would it take to implement them in a process kind of picture? And, like, how, what is the connection of causality there, for example? That's one open question we have at the end of our paper. That maybe helps you understand something about the kinds of non-classicality you actually need. Like, because this is a completely classical process in the process matrix language. Like, it's not it doesn't require you to think about the whole process matrix framework, right? So you could imagine these loops happen. This was a question that actually Chasla raised in the conference the previous week, where he was saying that it would be nice if someone tried to answer the question of whether, you know, this kind of connections, this kind of topology that the laps being connected this way, it's possible in any kind of classical GR kind of space time or not. Like, he considered it an important question to settle if these are even possible. Because these are kind of milder than the Gödel kind of curves, right? Like, they don't lead to logical paradoxes. So seems plausible that maybe there is a solution that where you find these possibilities. So this could be completely classical, right? Like, this doesn't require quantum. even this classical causal order for you know, locality to do quantum stuff. So I think that's the conceptual point, maybe. I don't know. But if you want to talk about non-classical space times or whatever, and this stuff is not it's not enough to show that you can use this stuff with local operations. Maybe you need, so this is it's an operational way to interpret, in some sense, what's going on with these non-causal processes. And I was wondering if this operational way to interpret it can be extended to the process matrix framework in general. So that's an open question, for example, to think about.
Yeah, so I find it very plausible to say that if you have a deterministic a causal process, that you should be able to convert that process into a basis of quantum states, which cannot be prepared by a system. And I would suspect that you can go beyond bits. If you had like one of them was, you know, if you had a quantum system which was 2, 3, etc., then you could still have a protocol somewhere that you draw X, Y, Z from the appropriate cardinality space. There's basically a protocol which might work, because if you have like a
so you want to use an indeterministic sort of process
so the state that you prepare associated with every x y z is a different state, and it's follows this. It's plausible to me that you could find a radio connection so that for every a causal deterministic process there's a associated basis. Not necessarily even arcuates, which, but it's also seems like that's a one-way relationship, because we know that you have these deterministic bases for, let's say, two qubits.
Yeah.
So you're doing this in the case of 3 qubits.
Yeah.
But we know that there are these deterministic projective measurements.
Yes, yes, yeah,
and
yeah.
Clearly, they're not going to map onto any
angle.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah. It's like you can get one from the other, but not.
Yeah, so let me just comment on that. So the reason I use this example and not the byproduct example, which is maybe the more famous one, which is what people call domino states. It's like a basis of 9 two-qubit states. So it's like a two-qubit basis.
Two-qubit.
Yeah. So that basis is very interesting. Like, I spent some time thinking about it. And obviously, like, so firstly, you cannot do it with these classical processes. That just follows from the fact that two-party processes have to be causal. So, you know, you cannot think of it as an adaptive measurement anyway. So, you know, it requires some sort of non-causal stuff, and two-party processes cannot do it. You need to entertain, basically, you will end up writing classical channels, which are not valid processes. They don't satisfy logical consistency. So if you were to interpret them as like actually loops in space-time or something, then they will be the kinds of loops that allow for grandfather paradoxes, which is maybe okay. I mean, I don't know. I think it's okay maybe to study it, but it's not within the framework of process functions. So in the sense that in order to avoid a paradox, you need to restrict the interventions. You need to restrict the kinds of things the particles can locally do. Then you can potentially, then there's no free choice for what maps you implement locally, right? So you kind of impose some self-consistency thing, like only do these things because these are the good things to do. Or like, I don't know, some laws of physics stop you from doing the thing that will create a contradiction or something. So it'll be that kind of process, like to do the qubit kind of basis. It'll not be a process technically, like in the sense, but it'll be a channel that requires fine-tuning in a sense.
There might be a way, like if you say, let me embed this qubit into 2 qubits, and rather than imagining I just have A and B, I say now I have A1, A2, B1, B2. That sort of forced it into a four-party configuration. And it's kind of natural because in a way, like if you look at the domino space, there's states where I need to measure 0 versus the subspace 1 and 2. Mm-hmm. You know, like that's the kind of thing, the binary measurement that splits up the qubit into 2 pieces. So, you know, thinking of the first qubit as the 1, 0 versus not, and the second qubit as the extra degree of freedom is not, is pretty natural. And now you've got a four-party situation, and maybe it maps onto one of these processes. I mean, in the way that it has here.
So what was the, so you wanted to simulate, you wanted to look at a qubit subspace of the two qubit thing, is that what you meant?
Yes.
Okay.
In other words, conceptualize the Q-trid as actually being two qubits,
where
one of the four states just has no support, and then, you know, think of it as a four-party state. Maybe the connection goes through again.
I wanted to mention this because, I'll just say something about this, because if you look at the unit tree that takes you from the two Q-trid computational basis to the domino basis, it has some control conditions, which actually look kind of exactly like the control conditions in the AFPW, like for this kind of circuit, so this unit tree maps you from computational basis to the shift basis. Okay, and you can see that the control conditions are like this, right? So if you have a 0, 1, you kind of change basis, right? You flip 0 to 1, like you go from Z basis to X basis. So if it's 0 and 1 here, then you apply a harder one, but otherwise you don't apply a harder one. And I mean, I'm giving this very kind of, you do this, that's that, but you're not actually making any observations here. It's just like, it's a unit tree, right? So you're not doing any thing like that. But in some sense, if you look at the unit tree that maps you from the computational basis to the shift basis, to the basis of interest, the structure of that unit tree already contains the, in some sense, the process as well. And the unit tree for the Q-trid, if you write it down, it looks kind of similar, like you can kind of, except like, you know, it has to act like these edges have to act in the two-dimensional subspace of the thing you're interested in, and then, you know, the control thing. But qualitatively, if you write it out, it kind of looks, it's not this circuit, but if you look at the control conditions, you can write down the process, like not the process, the channel that you need to implement it locally. So I know like what channel to use to do it, but it's not a process function. So the question is, how do you interpret that thing? Like, you know, how to sort of maybe talk about some meaningful restriction on the kinds of things that people do in their labs. But I don't know. Like, yeah. So I'm just trying to point out another connection, another way to think about the connection of these processes. So, yeah. I don't know if this logic helps. I mean, I guess I just moved on from your Q-trid embedding thing. Sorry.
Let me say one other thing, which I don't know if they'll work out, but like you're explicitly forbidding a single party to kind of its output have any influence on its input. But to some extent, that feels like it's too strong, because if I take a single party and I sort of, you know, imagine it as two, then I should be able to sort of allow the output of one to influence the input of the other, and vice versa. And so it feels more like you should not allow, you know, like.
I mean, it's a function of the fact that I assume some local causal order, right? Like, I assume that there's an input that precedes the outcome, right? So that's why I want to distinguish between the input and the output. I don't want the output signal back to the, like, that's the physical reason why you want to do that. But if you want to think of it as two parties, like, you know, the two different labs, like, you know, one with just an input, one with just an output, is that what you're saying?
I guess it's more like, you know, Ellie said, clearly, you can't go both ways. Why? Because we have a two-party, two-Q-trid example of quantum null locality without entanglement, but you showed us that there's no possibility of anything except causal process. And I'm just saying, well, that's not decisive. Like, there may be other ways of conceptualizing this two-Q-trid example, which does make a connection. And so you might have to deviate from your framework a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it necessarily requires a deviation. At least you agree with that, right? It cannot be the same framework that does that job. Yeah,
sure. Yeah.
But what kind of deviation you choose, like, you have some freedom in how you want to. And I guess you're giving me an example of the kind of freedom one could try to exploit.
Yeah.
I didn't think of that sort of freedom. I was just thinking of the obvious one, which was kind of restricting operations. But yeah, maybe that's another way to kind of think about how one might meaningfully extend this language of process functions to include things that otherwise seem paradoxical, but I don't know. I mean, the reasons, of course, would be because you're trying to build this kind of dictionary between these kinds of things on this side, on the causal stuff on this side. So, but I think to me it was kind of a very interesting observation that the structure was already contained. So basically, you would have discovered this AFPW process if you were thinking about it like 1999 or something, and you're like, what kind of stuff would I need to implement this locally? And then you would come up with exactly the structure of what people call the AFPW process now, which they found through some like enumerating some polytope stuff from different considerations, causal inequalities and stuff. So yeah, so basically any discrimination task of this type of non Caldwell entanglement requires that the associated process will violate a causal inequality in some sense. Because violation is equivalent to lack of a partial order. So, yeah. So that's the sort of logical connection.
Yeah, I have to
question.
Yeah. Well, you said the aspect in some way on the play. Well, you have your result, and there's the restriction that the processes should be boolean.
Oh, yes.
Important in the proofs, so do you think it should be just true for all cardinality?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's a good question because we focus on the boolean case because that was the case that was studied in the generalizations largely. I think you were involved in all the generalizations.
I think one of the papers, one of these two, I think you're right. Both of them are distinct ways of generalizing the same, but usually people only, I think it's just like historical reason, you just look at zero one and like binary input output, but a good way to generalize it actually, like this is another thing that you can work out, which we did sort of work out, but it's not in this paper, is if you look at this thing,
if you want to go to, for example, higher dimensional things, I don't know whether they say sort of construction. Ah, yeah, this was this one. So if you look at this paper, this has got like a recipe for constructing these monocardial entanglement bases for like n systems, where each system has dimension n minus one. So there you can, if you construct the corresponding processes, those are cardinality d minus one, like, you know, the input output. So you can do that. You can use the logic that I'm using here to construct new sort of instances of classical processes with a higher dimensional thing. And it's completely analytical because this thing's already worked out. I just need to use the dictionary. Yeah,
that's nice. Because the with large numbers of parties and input size, you can't brute force like
And this is a pretty analytical construction that uses I think the discrete Fourier transform type thing for three dimensions to
qubits.
It generalizes that picture to more than qubits. And so that I think this is a good route to constructing those things. And it's not hard to construct once you see the logic of the construction. So there's no fundamental reason, I think. So to answer your question, why it should be binary or anything, because I think I could prove a similar theorem for the kinds of bases that they have in that paper. I just need to write, it's just that the processes are not independently defined. The process will be defined starting from the bases, and then obviously the theorem is going to be true, because I can just work backwards.
But like in your proof, it relies somewhere on the movie. It's not like just general function of the unique fixed.
I think it just needs the fixed point kind of thing. So maybe in that sense, I don't think the fixed point thing requires binary. Yeah, so I think that's what we need, and that doesn't require a binary. It also requires this, the argument requires like this, this thing that when you take a reduced process, it's also a valid process, the function, process functions, which was in this, Eleftherios and Amin had this paper on process functions and grandfather actually international. So there they proved some results like that. We use those to sort of establish that. And I'm not sure if they were kind of restricted to binary ones. I'm not sure. So you can check that.
All right. There's no other questions.